This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Gary Wilson, contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau, discusses the funding and political reality of a plan to stop Asian carp, as well as other Great Lakes projects. But first, Kalamazoo's Winchell neighborhood was described as having favorable influences in the 1930s by the Homeowners Loan Corporation. The New Deal era program, designed to stabilize the housing market, says the neighborhood had transportation and good schools. And also that it was restricted, meaning deed restrictions ensured that only white people could buy homes in the Winchell neighborhood. Meanwhile, Kalamazoo's Lincoln neighborhood in the 1930s was considered hazardous, a long-term risk for investment, in part because it was near factories and congestion, but also because of the presence of Negroes, which then comprised 10% of the population. Bridge has examined how the reports and maps of neighborhoods in Kalamazoo and other cities helped ensure segregation for decades up to and including now. Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He joins us via Skype. And in the studio is the director of Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations, Tim Reddy, one of the people interviewed for the story in Bridge. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So if we look at these maps and these reports, how much can we say that federal policy drove where people lived by race in Kalamazoo as well as other cities in Michigan?
It did a lot. You know, this was very explicit, and the maps that Mike reported on and that a researcher, I believe with roots in Kalamazoo, actually came across were very explicit in terms of coding neighborhoods by the race of the people who lived there, and they were very not neutral, just the opposite. You know, they were very restrictive in terms of characterizing black neighborhoods or neighborhoods with immigrants, for example, as being undesirable, and white neighborhoods as being creditworthy and worthy of investing in.
Mike, you took a look at these maps and these reports. Was there much variation in different cities in Michigan, or was the pattern pretty consistent in terms of, you know, African American neighborhoods were going to be in a certain part of town and they were going to be labeled as a less desirable place to live?
Well, the HOLC used appraisers on the ground in many of these communities, but they had overarching principles that they did apply. So some of the language is slightly different. It's not as straight in some places, but the themes are almost universal. You know, there are four gradations of code. There's, you know, the green areas, which are considered desirable areas, and as Winchell was described, was a place where, you know, it was good in part because it restricted people of color from those neighborhoods. There was blue, which was past its peak, but still good. Yellow, which was considered definitely declining. And then there was hazardous. Now, this didn't tell people how to loan their money, but it gave them a framework with which to work in terms of, you know, what was considered a good place. And what you find is in almost every single place in Michigan, in the nine cities that these maps exist, for which these exist, if there's the presence of even 5% or a few Negroes, they are in the hazardous category. There's only a couple places where they're in the definitely declining in yellow. So there were other places that were red, and that was because there were no zoning or there were lack of transportation, lack of infrastructure in the presence of white folks. But those things could change. I mean, you could add pipes, you could add a road, you could put electricity and sewer there, but you couldn't change people from not being black. So they were always put in these areas that were considered the least, not likely, but least supportive of investment. And here's one thing that I think a lot of people should understand is today, post-civil rights movement, if you're going to go buy a house, you cannot consider race. You have to consider what kind of job they have, how much money they have in the bank, what's their credit history. But what this does back in the 1930s, and this extends for another 30 years, these ideas aren't knocked out of the water by law until the 60s. These made decisions based on race alone for an entire neighborhood, not on whether you could pay the bill, the mortgage, whether you could, you know, you had a great job or not. It didn't matter. It was what color were you and were you a desirable or an undesirable?
Tim, you say that you can look at these maps and you can see basically what's going to happen over the next 80 years based on what these maps and these reports are telling you. Draw that line for us between 1937 or so and 2017.
I think there are two frames of reference, one geographical and one demographic. Frankly, the African-American population of Kalamazoo in the 1930s, when this started, was not particularly large. Some of the areas that Mike referred to as being characterized as undesirable are predominantly African-American neighborhoods today, and very, very low income with very low property values. And there's certainly a relationship there. You know, the way I see it, though, is I'm particularly interested in this from more the demographic point of view and the opportunity to build wealth and to build, frankly, all of the resources and human capital within families that enable people to prosper and to enter and continue in the middle class. And government policy in the housing authority from the 1930s to the 1960s, in terms of where investments were made, what areas were worthy of investing in terms of mortgages or not, you know, were characterized by race, as we just described, and that systematically by government policy and by law channeled resources to predominantly white areas and kept them away from black areas. You know, the word, the term white privilege is something that I try to use sparingly because I think people can become numb to it or whatever. But this is about as concrete, literally and figuratively, I suppose, as you can get in terms of how government policy privileged white people and disadvantaged black people. And, you know, when you talk about housing, you know, for most people, your home is your principal source of wealth. And if you can, you know, if your home does not appreciate, or you don't, you know, you don't live in an area where homes rise in value because you were segregated or you were confined to areas that were belittled, if you will, by government policy, then, you know, this is a very clear example of how we got where we are today, where the average wealth of African Americans is something like $10,000, African American families, when it's, you know, 10 times at least that for white families.
And is it fair to say, Mike, that these programs in particular were an entry card to the middle class for many white families, allowing them to own a home that otherwise they may not be able to purchase?
Well, a couple things happened right at the time that these maps were created. And the Hulk loan program was an outgrowth of the Depression and a lot of foreclosures. When you wanted to buy a home before then, for the most part, you were going to get a 4-6 at most, like 7-8 year mortgage. And what Hulk did was it extended the terms to 10, 15, and ultimately, I think it went out to 20. So the size of the payment initially completely changed. And right after that, and that was just for rescuing existing mortgages. But right after that, the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, was created and adopted some of the same racial purity attitudes that Hulk did. And that extended loans out to 30 years. So it was basically the dawn of the modern mortgage. And this is happening. You know, we go right into World War II shortly after that. But when the war is over, the explosion in the suburbs has two things in place, has the Hulk racial attitudes in place, and it also has the FHA's long-term mortgages and the ideas on racial purity. So as we build the suburbs of Detroit, of Lansing, Grand Rapids, the only ones, not the only ones, but for the most part, the only ones that are able to enjoy that are white folks. And in Flint, one of the researchers that I talked to, you know, there were, I think, tens of thousands of mortgages insured by the FHA post-war. Only a couple dozen went to African Americans. They were not able to move into areas where whites already were because they were trying to keep, they didn't want racial imbalance. And so it did largely fuel the suburban move. Now, if you look at Detroit, there are African Americans throughout the suburbs. They've made moves that way that they're following the whites that who moved there beginning in the 50s. But since there was a 40-30 year head start, it still looks completely segregated. So what happened back then in the 30s and the 40s looks like it's historic. It's something your grandparents enjoyed. It set a pattern that continues today.
Well, and as you say in this story, it's going to take more than a generation or two to fix it. But you also examined some of the programs that other cities are looking into. What are some things that people are doing to try and make home ownership more possible for, say, minority groups, et cetera?
I mean, there has not been a silver bullet answer to this. Shaker Heights, Ohio, which has been a diverse suburb of Cleveland for decades, has gone to the extent of trying to help with down payment assistance to make sure it doesn't move from a 35 30% African-American community to a majority African-American. It's been very cognizant of it. It's a very liberal community that has just tried mightily to maintain its diversity. Oak Park, Illinois, back in the 70s, adopted housing policies. My sister lives there, and you, if you want to sell your house, you know, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but for decades, you couldn't put a real estate sign up. And the realtors were instructed that you can't steer African-Americans to one section of town south of the highway and the whites to another. And so, you know, it has largely remained a diverse community. It's, I think, 63% non-Hispanic white now. It's a little less white than it was before. But looking at the history of its peer suburbs of Chicago, it's done a far better job. But those are two small places. You know, they're very small. You've not seen it in, you know, a regional effort. I mean, there's been talk that Minnesota or Minneapolis has done a lot of work in the last 40 years, but it's not been largely successful. You know, every community and then the Minneapolis area had to set aside low-income housing. They share some tax base. But despite those efforts, segregation has crept in. I mean, nowhere to the extent that you'll see in a St. Louis, a Cleveland, or a Detroit, but it is still happening.
Detroit and Milwaukee and Chicago are about the most segregated cities in the United States. Kalamazoo is certainly quite segregated, but not at that level. The Census Bureau has measures of that and racial segregation, where we certainly have plenty of it, but not quite at the level of the cities I just mentioned. What we do have is more so than 4 out of 5 cities in the country is segregation by class. And class and race segregation do tend to correspond greatly. Predominantly Black neighborhoods are almost always also very low-income neighborhoods. And this really disadvantages the residents who live there, cutting them off from social interactions with potential employers, with people in networks and in professional positions, business owners, et cetera, people that white middle class people would come across in their social lives naturally, living in low income segregated neighborhoods. Again, partly the legacy of the policies we're discussing makes that far less likely to happen. And again, all of this is ongoing. One other thing I guess I would add in terms of current or recent policies in the Great Recession that was related to housing policies and shaky mortgages, subprime lending, et cetera, it's well documented that even though the redlining and the restrictive covenants and the kinds of policies that Mike wrote about in his article, or at least on paper, no longer permitted, what did happen to a large extent in the lead up to the 2008 recession was that African Americans were targeted for high cost loans. And again, they could afford, you know, when you looked at a white person and a Black person of similar means and resources, the Black person was much more likely to be sold a mortgage that had much higher costs and was more likely to be foreclosed upon for that reason.
Something that I can remember hearing back to my youth and well into my adult years is the idea that if African Americans move into a neighborhood, regardless of who they are, regardless of their position in life, what job they have, their socioeconomic status, that is going to drive down property values because the white families there will see Blacks moving in and decide that it's time to move out. Does that idea still persist today? And I'm wondering also if maybe the idea of it comes somewhat from these reports and these maps going back to the 30s.
It actually goes back before that. I mean, these maps come out of these economists, these real estate economists' ideas, these sociologists' ideas from some of the best universities in this country, the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, who held that was the case, which would justify the decisions based on economic grounds. We've had almost a century now of this attitude. And I would argue we don't know if we can live together because we've always lived apart. So, you know, I think it's kind of a hard thing to unravel. We don't know if it's true because we've never tried the alternative. I always argue in my neighborhood, you know, I don't care if, as long as they can afford the house, I don't care. I think the problem becomes is, let's say you live in a house in a neighborhood where every house is $100,000, and someone you don't like buys a house. Maybe they're, I don't know, Asian or they're African American. Well, if they pay for $100,000 and you don't sell your house for $80,000 to get out, then it doesn't change the value. And I think that's what happened. We saw that what happened across the nation, the blockbusting. You know, someone, an African-American, would buy a house on the east side of Detroit, and then every neighbor would sell at a discount, and the price would just plummet from there. Well, if they paid the right price, as you, same price as you did, it wouldn't have changed the neighborhood. So I don't know. It's one of those things where I think we're using, the researchers have talked about, we're almost using economics to justify our own biases and in a negative way.
Well, the biases in the housing sector obviously reflect the history of racism that unfortunately has been pervasive in our culture and in our institutions since our founding. And we did a lot to get rid of a lot of those laws in the 1960s and 1970s, but the attitudes are still there. You know, I think the blockbusting phenomenon still happens. Certain communities, as you mentioned, Oak Park, Illinois, for example, is one of them, instituted policies to try to keep whole neighborhoods or whole cities from flipping racially when a black person moves in. So it still happens, but I think we have to be vigilant and we have to think about what kind of community, what kind of society do we really want to live in? You know, this whole business about, white nationalism, white superiority is deeply ingrained in our culture. And this obviously is not tenable, not viable for a 21st century nation state, let alone the obvious justice and moral implications of what we're talking about.
Tim Reddy is the director of Western Michigan University's Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations. He has joined us in studio. Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He has joined the conversation via Skype. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
Bridge's story, Michigan's Segregated Past and Present, can be found at bridgemi.com. There's also a link available at wmuk.org.